compliment the committee for being here on time. Unfortunately, the chair had to get organized. So we're going to start this morning with work session on House Bill 3093. And is that yours?
Yes,
Bill, it is. I think, Bill, if you'll just share with us where we left off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Where we left off on this bill was a discussion regarding disclosure of researchers and other persons' names at the OHSU Animal Research Facility. If you remember, and I believe we actually adopted the A8 and A6 amendments to this bill already. The A6s are the emergency clause. I believe the A8s. I'm sorry, the A8s were the safe amendments.
Okay. All right.
What you should have in front of you is also the A9s, which are the sunset provision. They're quite lengthy. I think they are called a double amend, is the appropriate LC language.
Yes, I'd be happy to step in as deputy counsel.
Excellent.
Deputy counsel,
that would be perfect.
Speak to the issue. You don't want to get to.
Mr. Chairman, a number of us were kind of surprised when we saw the sunset amendment. Usually a sunset is a very short thing. But what this does, because 3093 amends existing statute, what this sunset does is it repeats the statute and deletes the provision that we mean to sunset in this amendment. So with that deletion, this whole thing goes into effect January 2nd, 2006. That amounts to a two-year sunset. And they did it this way because it's existing statute. So this actually repeats the existing statute in the bill and in existing law, with the exception of the deleted material about Oregon Health Sciences University, which would not go into effect on January 2nd, 2006. So it does make sense to me now, and I hope I haven't further confused the debate by my explanation.
All right. No, I don't think you have. It's perfectly consistent with what we usually get.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't say from whom, but we are in a work session. Mary Nolan, Representative Nolan, you're here. I was told that you're here to speak on this issue, and I'll allow you the privilege.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Mary Nolan. I represent House District 36, which includes the main campus of OHSU. And I just wanted to speak briefly because I know there's been some discussion about issues relating to this amendment. I wanted to thank the committee for considering adding a sunset clause here. I think that provides OHSU with the opportunity to accomplish its objectives. I also wanted to thank Senator Burdick for her efforts to make sure that while we are protecting OHSU's research and researchers and those who support it, we are also doing everything we can to protect access by the public to appropriate information. The dash A9 amendments provide that. I understand you've also looked at a dash A10s, which include the same sunset and exclude the names of the researchers from protected information. Either of those amendments accomplishes what I hope to accomplish, and I thank you for your support for that.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. All right. We are in work session. I'm sorry, Senator.
I don't know.
Used to be Rep. Senator.
Yeah, I don't have a question of Representative Nolan, but did we discuss the A-10s before?
I think we didn't discuss them specific. I think there were discussions in general before they were actually drafted in the national public.
Could I have a sort of update on the difference between the A9 and the A10? And we also have an A11.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just not quite behind the eight ball this morning, so if I could.
You got up and walked 4 miles today.
Yeah.
You're full of energy
today. I know,
today.
I am.
Okay, do you want to chat about something here?
Well, I just want to know the difference between the A10 and A9, because frankly, I don't like the bill, and I'm trying to work with you folks making it better, but What's the difference between those two?
A10 and A9.
Mr. Chairman, if I could help on that.
Madam Vice Chair.
The A10 amendments does include the sunset, but it also, as I understand it, it also, I have to see it here. I thought that the purpose of it was to exempt the actual researchers.
Right, I think it protects everyone but the researchers.
Everyone but the researchers, and there was some discussion of that since testimony came before the committee.
And I think, right, if you'll recall, Andrea Myers from ACLU in the original discussion had the internet issues. I think she raised the concern about the fact that much of the information that was being sought to protect was already available on the internet. So I think that that was her take at trying to.
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Council. Get back to you.
Sorry, Senator Walker, if you look at the page 7s of the A9s and the A10s, the A9s, page 7, line 4, include the words "that is engaged in," which would refer to the researchers. That's missing if you look at the A10s, page 7, line 11.
Okay.
So if you compare.
So A10 allow the information about the researchers to be public.
Right.
Which it already is, because I have a copy of what's on the internet. So.
Right, and it's my understanding from speaking, if I might, Mr. Chairman, speaking with the various interested parties, that OHSU's position is certain information about the researchers will naturally be public because they publish studies, they have a website, obviously, but that they could still withhold, they could better control the information that is released about the researchers if they were included in this bill. But, of course, certain information will always be out there in the public domain. Mm-hmm. But other things, such as their home address, social security number, date of birth, maybe. Now, most of that stuff is exempt already under the FOIA regulations, but that is, as I understand it, their argument that if the researchers are excluded, they have less control over what information about them is released to the public.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that commentary, but I don't agree with it. The researchers are the ones who I want to know about, and I understand everybody's been working on this. And we didn't talk about this on our walk this morning, Madam Vice, but I still have a problem, and if you want to move forward on the A10, I'm not going to support those, or on the A9, because I think that it's valuable information. I have the letter from Willamette Week, who talked about how hard it was for them to give information on the Primate Research Center. And I just have concerns. I don't have concerns about shielding the information from the other folks who are involved there. I think they need protection, but I think that law that exists today protects them from the information that they want to protect them from.
All right, thank you. Senator Burdick, you wanted to...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think maybe it won't change Senator Walker's ultimate decision, but I think I would like to ask that Janet Phillips to come forward. She works in the legal department for OHSU, and we had a conversation earlier this week that I would like to kind of recap and get on the record about how this provision is going to be used.
All right. Good morning.
I'm Janet Phillips, legal counsel for Oregon Health and Science University. I'm happy to answer any question or comment, Senator Burdick, on what you just asked about.
Okay. Well, first of all, the exemption for anyone involved in the primate research appears will be put into the conditional section of the public records law, which means that if a public interest finding, if a finding is made that it's in the public interest to release the information, then even though the exemption exists, it can be released on a case-by-case basis. And if you could just share with us what your process will be, for example, when a reporter from the Oregonian comes up to to OHSU and wants some information about primate researchers, and wants to get the name of a researcher. What will be your process for reviewing that request?
That probably has two parts. One part is any request for the information itself still must be honored even with this bill, because the information on the science, the protocol, the care of the animal, the use of the animal, everything relating to the science and animal care, and deliberations on whether or not the scientific protocol will be approved are still subject to public disclosure, and this bill does not change that. In a conversation that we've had recently, the question was, what if an Oregonian reporter were to say, I would like the protocol, all the protocols that were authored by Dr. So-and-so, who is the scientist in charge of certain types of science, would we then be either legally or morally obligated to provide that information? And the answer to that is yes. We would, again, pull out the information regarding the research at that request.
Well, and just to stop you for a second, it's not just, this would not be a public interest finding. This would be, no, if someone had the name of the researcher, which testimony has told us is available from other sources, including on the Internet, so they have the name of the researcher, it goes to OHSU, and the reporter, whoever is requesting the information, says, I want all the research, or I want this research that has been done by this researcher, and they have the name already. They don't need the name. They have the name. They want to narrow their search to research from this particular researcher. Then under this amendment, you are in no way relieved from your requirement to release that information.
That's correct. That's correct, Senator.
Okay. Now, if they were to, the name of the researcher is exempt.
Yes.
But if a reporter or some other person made a request for all the researchers who are doing XYZ type of research up at OHSU, what would be your process for determining whether or not to release that information?
If I understand the question correctly, we would undertake a search to provide the records of that type of research. Because
that's not my question.
Okay.
Under the conditional section of the public records law, even though there's an exemption, you have the ability to release the exempted information, even if you make a public interest finding. Would you share with us your process for determining that?
An exemption under the public records law does not prohibit us from disclosing information. It authorizes the public body to withhold information. The process that we follow is to not, on a blanket basis, deny every request simply because we have the authority to do that. That would be stupid. We don't operate that way. The head of our media department works it out, negotiates with the reporter what the information is that the reporter is really seeking, and the judgment is made as to whether or not to invoke the exemption.
Okay, and who else is involved in that conversation?
I would say primarily three, perhaps even four units within OHSU are jointly involved in deciding whether to invoke a public records exemption. One is the media department. The second is governmental relations, and especially in view of the fact this has a sunset clause, our governmental relations people will be very involved in monitoring and giving advice on how we can best honor our commitment to treat this narrowly so that we can bring that information back in a couple of years. The third is our own department. The legal department is involved in assessing whether an exemption applies and then whether the best judgment is to invoke that assessment, exemption rather. And the fourth, obviously, is the unit that is affected, if it's the Primate Center or one of our many other scientific research units. Since those folks are the people who have the highest interest in deciding whether or not to invoke an exemption, I think we might all assume that their inclination would be to want to use this exemption whenever possible, but they're not the decision maker. It's a much broader group of OHSU that makes the decision.
And if people aren't happy with your finding on the public interest provision, then what can they do if they don't agree with you?
There is both an informal and a formal process that would be available. One is ultimately the decision maker is Dr. Kohler. And Dr. Kohler can exercise his judgment as president of the university on whether or not information ought to be disclosed. The more formal process, of course, if there is disagreement, if we do invoke an exemption and there's disagreement, then it is taken to the local district attorney's office. And in our county, that would be Michael Schrunk in Multnomah County.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you getting this on the record. Mr. Chairman, this is important to me that that OHSU is committing themselves to using the exemption for what it's intended, is to protect the safety of people who are involved in a controversial activity. And so we'll see how it works. We've got a 10-year sunset coming before us.
All right, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your explanations in response to Senator Burdick's question, Ms. Phillips, but in your own letter that you provided to this committee, there is no date, but it was at our last hearing. On the second page, you talk about the detail. You say, such detail used out of context and twisted without regard to scientific accuracy is then used to fuel support for intimidation of or violence against individual scientists and their research. What you're talking about is information about the researchers. So your assumption is that everyone is going to twist that information and use it differently. And then our letter that we got from John Schrag, dated May 19th, says that on several occasions we found it necessary to involve our lawyer in the process to get what were clearly public records. And the reason for that resistance was found when they discovered you were using electroejaculation on the monkeys and that practice had been changed. So how do you reconcile your comments and what Willamette Week has run into?
I do not believe every person who obtains information will twist it. And I don't believe that legitimate members of the press twist information. They may write stories that are negative or hard about OHSU and its research, but I don't believe every person twists it.
I want to throw something in here. One time in the Willamette Week, years ago, they had quotes attributed to me from a speech I gave on the House floor, and I had it transcribed, and I got a tape, and I presented it to the publisher. And when I confronted him on it, he said, "Well, we think you meant to say what we said you said."
Mr. Chairman, let's not turn this into a trash-a-rama on the press.
Well, I mean, that's a true story. It's like, we think you meant to say what we said you said. So, you know, you can't win sometimes, I guess is the point I'm making. So,
are we ready for a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
One question. You know, we are building in a 2-year sunset, and I'm wondering what you intend to do over the next 2 years to try to reduce the conflict in this area.
We do intend to develop an internal process to involve, on a formal basis, to involve all those units that I just mentioned in response to Senator Burdick's question, to have a track record of who makes requests that may be subject to this exemption and how we handle those requests so that we can bring that information back when it's time for this provision to sunset, and so that we handle it responsibly and narrowly in the meantime.
Thank you.
Chairman, I would move the -A9 amendment to House Bill 3093.
Senator Burdick moves the A9 amendment to House Bill 3093. Is there a discussion in addition to what we have, Senator Walker?
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no. I appreciate Senator Burdick's work on this and everyone who's been involved, but I think we should be moving the -10. Obviously, there's not support on the committee for that. I just think this is This is not acceptable. And I do hope, Senator Burdick, that the information you put on the record today will prove to be a wise thing that we've done here today. And in 2 years, we'll be revisiting this very issue. And I suspect many of us will be here on this committee to do that. But I can't support this.
All right. Any other, any other discussion? Any objections? I take Senator Walker clearly dissents. Any other objections to the motion? There are no other objections. The motion passes. I do want to say that I guess my general bend is that the more access to public records, the better, because I'm just about ready to take out after DHS on some stuff that I think they're very, very difficult to penetrate, try to get information from, and I'm not happy with them. And I think that really the stewardship over this issue, it's incumbent upon OHSU to deal appropriately and in a way that's responsible, and I think you will. And if I'm back here next session and on this committee, and if you don't, then I'll be here with Senator Walker asking to repeal it, so,
or
to sustain
it,
Senator Burdick. So, okay?
Those and the sixes is what I have last time, so we're putting
okay.
We don't need the areas. We need to take them out.
What do you mean?
Those are your safe cleaners.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3093 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick now moves House Bill 3093 as amended before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there additional discussion?
Just one, Senator Mr. Walker. Chair. I just would like to be clear on what amendments we have adopted because I have a bunch of them here.
All right. Council?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I have that we've adopted the -A6, -A8, and -A9 amendments.
Okay.
Okay.
That's good, according to my record, too.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Any objections to the motion? Senator Walker, I assume you're a no?
I'm a no.
Okay. Senator Walker, dissent. The motion passes. Senator Burdick, you can carry this thing.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
All right. Let me see. What is the next most fun thing we can do today? Let's see. Senator
Brown, we could
Brown is here or was here?
She stepped out, but we could do that at 6:10.
6:10. Representative Dingfelder is here. She gone?
Here.
Well, let's do 6:10.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 6:10, we heard testimony on March 31st, 2003. Senator Kate Brown spoke, as well as Steve Dole and Craig Plunkett from Crime Victims United, Rebecca Gandy from the Oregon Coalition, Jason Barber from Crime Victims Assistance, and Chris Stringer from the DA's Association. Connie Gallagher's here. Briefly, this is a bill that deals with employers allowing crime victims to go to a criminal proceeding. There's been substantial amendments, and I can go through those very quickly.
All right.
Subsection 2, if you look, Jane prepared a Hannah Gross version of the -3s, and it is the -3s that we're looking at. First of all, in Section 2, this would be applicable to covered employers. A covered employer is an employer who has six or more persons in the state of Oregon for each working day. Crime victim has been limited substantially. Under the amendments, a crime victim is a person who has suffered financial, social, or psychological or physical harm as a result of a Measure 11 crime. These, as you know, are the serious crimes that are dealt with mandatory minimum sentences. It also includes an immediate family member of that person. Immediate family is defined here and would include most all household members. Then, in Section 4, on page 2 of the Hannah Gross bill, it makes it clear that this section would be unlawful employment practice, meaning that if an employer does not allow these employees to go to a criminal proceeding, it would be unlawful employment practice, and that would be not be subject to the Bureau of Labor's administrative action, but would go directly to a civil court, or a circuit court civil action. I will also note, and in case you do not recall,
the employer has an ability to show that such allowing the employee to go would be an undue hardship, and then they could opt out of this. So if the that's in Section 3, that was in the original bill, so I just want to cover that very briefly. There can be that showing. Then the other change is just that in Section 7, that was deleted. That said that they would have to post a notice, an employer would have to post notice. That has been deleted, I believe, for fiscal concerns. Section 7 of the Dash 3 amendments make it clear that a person who has been aggrieved by this unlawful practice under this new section can file a civil action. They can ask for an injunction against the employer to allow them to go to the criminal proceedings. They can ask for back pay, and they can ask for attorney's fees for taking this action. So I believe that covers the amendments that the Dash 3s bring to the bill.
All right, Ms. Gandy signed up. Do you need to testify today? All right. So let the record show Ms. Gandy supports the Dash 3 amendment. Work session, Amendment 610.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I would move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 610.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 610. Is there discussion on?
Well, I think they did a good job, Mr. Chair, working out these details. I see the last time we heard this was on the 31st of March, and I like the changes.
All right, good. Any further discussion? Council.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make one point. We're going to look at when we limited this to Measure 11 crimes, aggravated murder is not a Measure 11 crime. It's outside of Measure 11, so I spoke to Senator Brown, and Christian brought that up, and we can amend that on the House side if that's okay with you. To make sure that this is applicable to aggravated murder, which I know was the intent.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion on the motion? No further discussion. The motion passes. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 610 to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 610 as amended before the Senate with due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? If none, the motion passes. Senator Starr.
Senator Brown.
Senator Brown. Oh, this is Brown's bill, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, she's not here, though. She's not here.
She'd want to carry it.
Oh. But she, yeah. She did. Okay. Representative Cruz is here. I was going to say, on 2318, we're not going to hear that today. If there are people that are waiting specific to that bill, we're not going to hear that one today. The chair is going to hold that for additional amendments for DHS to make their life miserable. All right. So we're done with that one. Let's go to 24. Representative Cruz, what are you here for? 2490.
Oh, that's the children.
Mr. Taylor, you are here. So. All right. Let's do a public hearing on 2490. And Representative Cruz, if you'd like to come forward and redeem the time for you.
Mr.
Chairman, Heather Burnell with me. That would be
acceptable. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jeff Priest, State Representative, House District 7. This is a bill that initially was designed to go through the Health and Human Services network, but somehow our attempt to pre-session file the bill got sidetracked, and in searching for a relating clause that would work, we ended up borrowing one from Representative Shetterly that fit, and so it's going through judiciary committees, which is absolutely fine also. You know, currently there are more than 20,000 children in Oregon with parents in prison or a parent in prison. 39% of current foster care population has a parent who is a convicted felon. Children with an incarcerated parent are many times more likely to someday become incarcerated themselves. House Bill 2490, as amended, will support the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project work group's efforts to continue to improve the health and well-being of these children in five areas of criminal justice system, including arrest, judicial proceedings, jails, prisons, and transition back into the community. I support the efforts of the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project, which is something that was created last session. And it's important that I think we continue to develop this. Prevention clearly is the key here, and this is an incredibly good preventative measure, and I would recommend the committee's favorable ruling on this bill. And if it's okay, Mr. Chair, I would like for Heather to be able to give her testimony. She has some time commitments too here. So.
All right. Thank you very much. Heather, go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, I'm Heather Brunel. I was formerly incarcerated. I was released probably 90 days ago. And I have a 4-year-old child at home. And this project, these programs have helped my reentry into society and to being a parent. I've never been a parent. My child was 4 weeks old when I went to prison. And it's very overwhelming to return into society and to have these skills, let alone not to have them. And some of the women or people incarcerated, period, are there for years, and they don't, and their children are out there for years. So going through the transition without these skills is unimaginable, and I would just ask that this can happen. Make this happen.
All right, Heather, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Senator Walker?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brunel, were you at Coffee Creek?
Yes, I was.
And I did a tour of Coffee Creek and met some very fine young women, and I think you were among those in the room and talked to us about the program?
Yeah.
I thought so. Well, welcome back on the other side. And we were really compelled by the testimony we received from all of you when we were there. I think Senator Starr was with me on that trip as well, so I'm sure he wishes you well. I think this program is awesome. Anything we can do to continue to make it better. And what's really interesting is it comes on the heels of a bill we just passed out of this committee and off the Senate floor, where the Department of Corrections wanted to send male inmates out of state because we're running out of room here. And my objection to that was that they didn't put any requirements on who was going out of state. So the department listened to those concerns, and now inmates who have children under the age of 18 will be kept here so that they can stay with their families. And that's so important, as you have just testified
to. My husband is actually incarcerated right now, and so that's very important to know.
That's great. So your husband is incarcerated now, and
yeah, he's at OSP minimum.
Okay, and so since we're going to keep inmates here, you'll be able to continue that family bonding and success rate.
They have just allowed our visits, so we will be able to. We were just there visiting him last night, me and my child. So
great.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and I wish you well.
Thank you.
I know you can do it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, just in closing, I'd like to say I've had questions over my time in the building on some of the programs that we have in our prison system. I would say this is one of the more positive ones, and I would like to see it move forward.
All right,
thank you very much.
All right, Janet Carlson, Ron Adams, assume you're on the same team here. No one signed up in opposition to this, so Chair would like to try to expedite things if possible. There's a Diana, and I can't read the last name. She signed up. Okay. Whatever you say, come on up. You can pronounce it better than I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner, formerly state representative from several districts, but I won't go into all that. I appreciate the committee's interest in this bill, and last session I was the representative that introduced House Bill 3037 that, by the good graces of Senator Minnis, was added into Senate Bill 133 towards the close of session. I became connected with the issue when I conducted a jail study for Marion County in 1999, and did some research around the nation, looked at national research about this issue. What I learned was that there are numerous offenders in our prisons that have multiple children, sometimes by different partners, and that very little attention has been paid in our criminal justice system to the children. And there is an intergenerational cycle of crime. Research has borne this out. I think that there's a sense in society that if someone's an offender, they're a bad parent, and so their children will just sort of magically disappear. But the truth is that families reunite when offenders leave the system, and oftentimes the offenders don't have the skills and don't model good parenting so that their children become productive citizens. So I think that what happened with the Oregon model and the task force is that we were able to come up with, as Representative Cruz said, some positive solutions to the problem. I believe that this problem takes a multidisciplinary and multi-jurisdictional approach. The report of the on Senate Bill 133, which was the bill that passed last session, which is being handed to you, shows 27 partners listed on the last page that are working on this issue together. The outcomes in the short time that the bill has been in place, the committee has come up with a number of recommendations throughout the system. There has been a cutting-edge parenting program that's been developed and that has gained national attention, and there's going to be an evaluation study done of that parenting program to determine the outcomes. There's been an informational piece that's been developed that's been shared not only at the state level but at the local level called How to Explain Jails and Prisons to Children, a caregiver's guide, because one of the recommendations is that caregivers don't really know what to do sometimes when a parent is incarcerated. And the Department of Corrections that did the presentation to the interim committee that I sat on, I was impressed that they said there were some unanticipated outcomes with the program in its early stages for the offenders themselves. They recognized there would be some long-term outcomes for the children, but for the offenders they found that they were more open to treatment while they were in prison, and that it was an experience for them that touched them on a level that other treatment programs did not. So I want to express my strong support for the bill, and again, I appreciate the chair and others' interest in the issue.
Now, Janet, you hold a doctorate in something.
I do.
What is the discipline?
Special education and community resources, but the general issues on outcomes for children and families. Right. That's what I did my dissertation on.
And I think I first met you when you were working for DAS. Or the
I was a committee administrator, a lowly public administrative trainee in the 1991 session. And you were on Ways and Means.
And my wife used to be my staff.
Exactly.
Ron, you want to chat?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Ron Adams. I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, and I promise to be amazingly brief, if that's okay with you. The I first heard about CHIPS about 3 years ago. I had heard that children of incarcerated parents are the most at-risk youth in the state, and by law, Oregon Youth Conservation Corps must serve 75% at-risk kids. So I went to Ben DeHaan, asked him about what they were doing. He suggested I join Claudia and the CHIPS task force. I did that. I've been a regular member. I will just simply say, and I didn't know who all was going to present before I did, but Representative Cruz is right. This is one of the most amazingly positive programs, and Senator Walker referred to that, that I have seen, and I've been around lots of things with state over time. I don't have any written testimony. I'm simply here to support. Our role as the Youth Conservation Corps is relatively minor, I think. We try to get these kids hired during the summer because we know that if they've got a job, it enhances their odds. And we also try to share the expertise we've acquired and curriculum across the alternative schools that we work with. So that's my input. Urge your passage. Bill, how they do.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Diana Janowski. My husband is an inmate at Oregon State Penitentiary, and I have two children. I've been involved with the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project for about 2 years, and it is absolutely amazing. The parenting program helps not only with my husband, with my kids when they go in to visit, and it's just our children are forgotten. The schools don't acknowledge that there's any situation that the parents are in prison. My kids have been discriminated against in school if things happen. We had a situation where my daughter was told, because of the situation with your dad being in jail, we're just going to let this go. And she didn't do anything wrong. Somebody else spit on her. And they assumed that because her parents incarcerated that she just needs to be step aside and not worry about it. The work that the group on this has done is amazing to bring attention to all levels of society that our kids didn't commit any crime, and their parents shouldn't be punished for the sins of their parents. So.
Good. Appreciate it. Any questions by the committee or other comments? There aren't any other persons wishing to testify. House Bill 2490. I believe there are no amendments to 24. All right. Work session. House Bill 2490. Senator Burry. Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2490 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation unamended by this committee. Is there any discussion on the motion? Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I was in love with this program last session. I just think it's fabulous. And I want to thank Claudia Black for her hard work in the department in helping us get acquainted with the criminal justice system and giving us the opportunity to see these people make such good progress, and it's so nice to see them back on the outside. This program is awesome. I mentioned it the other day that it's not the children's fault that their parent is incarcerated or parents, and anything we can do to make it better for the kids and to make sure they themselves don't follow that path, I think is wonderful, and we're doing it. So.
All right. Thank you very much. Any further discussion on the motion? There is none. Any dissenting votes? There is none. Motion passes. Senator Walker, would you carry that bill?
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. And we're going to go to a work session on Senate Bill 895.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 895, we heard testimony on April 30th. It's sponsored by Senator Morissette, who I believe was here. Senate Bill 895, as introduced, amended Chapter 471 and 410, which is the section of Oregon statute that deals with a person who sells or gives alcohol to either a visibly intoxicated person or is a person other than a parent and gives or sells alcohol to a person under the age of 21. Originally, as the bill was introduced, this measure would have said if a person who does give or sell alcohol to a person who's under 21 commits a Class C felony, if the person then injures or kills someone. That testimony was on that, and I think from that the Dash 4 amendments minimized this bill quite a bit. That language is taken out so that there is no Class C felony in the Dash 4s. Also, you heard testimony about restitution for a person who sells to a person who does then injure someone. That portion is taken out as well. So in the Dash 4 amendments, what remains is you have increased mandatory minimum penalties or fines for a person who sells alcohol to a person under 21. Briefly, for a first conviction, the fine would increase from $350 to at least $1,000. For a second conviction, it would increase from $1,000 to $2,500. And a third one would be from $1,000 to $5,000. There also is an exception to that for a person who is a licensed or is an agent of a licensed person who has a license from OLCC to sell alcohol, a clerk at a grocery store, etc. That person, because they're in the commercially, they sell alcohol and may sell alcohol to a person who is under 21. Their first conviction would be less. It would be $350, and for a second or subsequent would be $1,000, unless they know the person is under 21. Then they would be subject to the same penalties that I went over in the first part. That's the Dash 4 amendments for 895.
All right.
If you have any questions, John Steubenvall is here from OLCC.
Actually, I want to thank John for working on the amendments, and I think having heard the criticisms or the discussion earlier, I think they responded appropriately by crafting some more narrow amendments. So.
Question of counsel.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're just basically increasing the fines. So I'm going to give you the scenario of two roommates, college roommates, living together. One is 21, one is 20. 21-year-old buys a six-pack for them to share at their home, and conceivably the 21-year-old could be fined $1,000 for doing so?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, that is correct. That's my reading of this measure.
Okay. I realize what people are trying to do here, but you got to think of those scenarios, and I just can't go along with that.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I should also add, under current law, a person who sells or gives alcohol to a person who's under 21 commits a Class A misdemeanor. That's the current law. It would technically, you could be fined for up to $5,000 and be in prison for that. That would not occur, in my experience. It would be much less than that. And so this would set the minimum sentence and would increase it by $650. That's correct, from $350 to $1,000. So there would, the judge would have to do that fine.
The judge would have to do the fine. Is there a sentence involved?
It's a Class A misdemeanor. In my experience, these would a district attorney would normally make this a violation, would reduce it to a violation. Mm-hmm. So technically, I think in most cases, on a first offense, that would be it. It would probably just be a fine.
Mm-hmm. I'm just a little torn here because we recently had a death in Lane County of a young man, but he was 22, and he went to the hospital, and Senator Atkinson just remonstrated about his death. And they were had all been drinking, but they'd been drinking in a public location, and then he ingested medication that was given to him at the hospital. I understand we have college drinking problems. We have roommates who buy for others. I don't know. I remember the testimony from John Steubenbaugh about how this is a real problem. I'm just, you know, I'm mindful of the fact that Senator Ringo's called me Hang 'em High Walker this session, and I just kind of worry that, that's what I'm doing here. There are situations that would get caught up in this that I just don't think belong there. But,
all right.
Do you have Senator Burdick wanted to comment? Maybe I.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask counsel, if it is reduced to a violation, does the mandatory $1,000 fine go in?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
under my reading, I don't think so, because you'd still have a violation of subsection 2, and the way it's written, it would still be a $1,000 fine. That's my reading of it. Of course, retired district attorney John Bradley is here, so you could always tease him and ask him about that.
Yeah, he gets drug in all the time.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to canvass the audience to get an answer to the question, please.
Well, and your question is what?
My question was, if they reduce it to a violation, would the mandatory fine still apply?
Well,
Mr. Chairman and Senator, I'm confident it would, because you'd still be it would still be a violation of Section 2, and so it would just be handled non-criminally, so I think it would still be $1,000.
But you still have the ability that the court, and we had this issue in another bill with a fine issue where we had a minimum, and the courts could adjust and make payment plans and suspend portions of it, et cetera, et cetera. So this isn't doing anything to take away some discretion that the courts currently have, if I understand correctly.
Mr. Chairman, I think courts, in my experience, have been very creative in situations where a defendant just doesn't have any money.
Right.
And I think that in a case like this, even if the judgment was entered at for $1,000, sometimes I've seen judges do a probation to allow for them to do a payment plan, so that you have 6 months to pay it off, something like that. But that's still possible. The judgment would have to be that $1,000, and then the creativity could come on trying to figure out how to get it paid off.
Right.
Well, and Mr. Chair, one of the common ways for kids around the campus area to get alcohol, and I imagine anyone else, because my kids told me about it, is the shoulder tapping. They go find a bum near one of the little convenience stores and give him some money, and he goes in and buys them a beer. And these people are homeless street people. They don't have that kind of money to pay those fines, but...
Okay. Did you call them bums?
Well, that's what the kids call them.
Oh, okay. You were quoting someone else. There you go. All right. Indigent homeless person.
I asked my kids, well, how do you guys get alcohol? And I said, oh, it's real easy. And I got an education because I had no idea that they do that. And, yes, that's what they call them. They're homeless, indigent people who have serious alcohol problems.
All right. We're in work session. Anybody want to move to dash four? Because we got a bunch of other bills. Senator Burdick.
I would move the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 895.
Senator Burdick moves the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 895. Discussion in addition to what we've already had. Any objections to the adoption of the dash four amendment? There is none. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman,
Burdick.
Yep. I move Senate Bill 895, the Hanging High Act, to the Senate floor and do pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick now moves Senate Bill 895 as amended before the Senate will do pass recommendation with the title Hanging High Act. Hanging High Light. Okay. Any discussion?
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote no for now because I got to think about this.
All right. Any objections? Senator Walker's noted as a dissenting vote. There are sufficient votes to pass the motion. Bill passes, and I don't know who likes this. Can you carry this, Senator Farrell?
If you wish, Mr. Chairman.
Didn't you, like, lose a bill on the floor yesterday?
Mr. Chairman, that issue's not quite decided yet.
Was that bill not my bill? But my
that is your bill, Mr. Chairman, and a good bill, I might add.
I will entrust this to you then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
I hope that your trust will not be misplaced.
I hope so, too. All right. Next up, we've got Craig. You're gone.
Goodbye.
Oh, Representative Dingfelder, you're here at 3259. The public hearing. Any other members out there? I don't want to disrespect members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the Judiciary Committee, for the record, I'm State Representative Jackie Dingfelder. I represent House District 45 and chief sponsor of this measure, and I want to thank the chair and the members for hearing this bill today. I very much appreciate that. Hopefully you have a packet in front of you with my testimony and some background information. Yes? Thank you. As you well know, the proliferation of methamphetamines is a growing problem in our communities, and one of the problems associated with the drugs are the labs that are used to manufacture it. Many of the chemicals and substances used in the manufacturing are toxic and otherwise harmful, and they pose a real health risk to humans. I provided some background materials for your review in your packet. Included in that packet is a copy of the recent Portland Tribune article, which highlights the growing problem of meth in our communities. I've also included an overview of the cleanup and recertification process. I've introduced this bill because I am concerned that citizens are not receiving adequate information about the dangers associated with these meth labs. In Portland, the only notification neighbors receive is a direct posting on the lab structure, which is sometimes removed within 24 to 48 hours, and committee members, I have a sample here for you so you can see this is what's posted on the structure itself. So this is the only notice right here that residents are currently receiving. And in fact, this issue was initially brought to my attention by a constituent who learned about a neighboring meth lab from her children. What this bill does is encourages local government to provide notice about the site in question. The notice shall include the phone number of the Department of Human Services. This is the agency responsible for overseeing decontamination of these sites. And DHS's website, which contains information about the dangers associated with these labs. With regards to the bill, I've worked very closely with the City of Portland, the Association of Realtors, and the League of Oregon Cities. And I want to thank them for helping me craft a better bill. We've worked through several issues. And I know of no opposition to House Bill 3259A at this time. I just want to briefly go over the dash 4 and 5 amendments, which should be before you, and these are primarily technical fixes. The A-4 amendment addressed the issue of residences located in unincorporated areas within an urban growth boundary. And so we were able to resolve this with the dash 4s. In the original bill, Also, notice would be provided to a residence, not the occupants who reside in the residence. And the principals involved believe that for the purposes of carrying out the notification process, it is sufficient to send a notice to a person in each residence. So legislative council suggested the -A5 amendments to address this issue. My primary intent with this bill is to inform citizens, particularly when such real health risks are present, and I feel that this bill will help provide citizens with the information that they need to protect themselves and their children from the very real dangers that these sites possess. House Bill 3259A passed unanimously out of the House Judiciary Committee, and it also passed unanimously on the House floor. I respectfully ask that the committee adopt these technical amendments and send the bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, or some of my colleagues who worked with me on this bill might be able to provide additional information.
All right. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Questions, comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to commend Representative Dingfelder for the work she's put in on this. And I've heard feedback from several people who were singing your praises for your diligence on this and how open you were for talking to everyone on this. It's a good deal.
Thank you. Right.
Is Mr. Landauer here? Did you want to speak? Sure. We can bring you up here and ask you questions about your golf game or anything.
Senator Ringo. I don't see anything useful with this relating clause. So.
I see.
Boy, I feel some relief over here.
All right. Okay, we have Mr. Landauer's testimony. Work session 3259.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Brady.
I think since these are technical amendments, I'll move both the -A4 and -5A5 amendments to 3259, House Bill 3259.
Senator Brady moves the adoption of the A5 and A4 amendments to House Bill 3259. Any discussion? Any objections? No objections. Motion passes. Senator Brady.
I would move House Bill 3259 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick now moves House Bill 3259 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mr. Landauer, don't ever say I didn't do anything for you. Motion passed. And actually, I think I'll.
Okay.
I'm going to carry this one. Make some positive comments about Representative Dingfelder on the floor.
She did a good job.
All right, let's see. 2425 should be ready to go. I'm in the work session on 2425. Bill, that's yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2425 comes to you from the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee, and this relates to disclosure of information about security. This is a result of the September 11th. Legislation. It's to ensure or to make it a little bit more difficult for people who may be involved in terrorism in getting hold of security plans and other information like that. You discussed public records before, and you may notice on page 1, the following public records are exempt from disclosure unless public interest requires disclosure in a particular instance.
All right. And we do have amendments in our packet, but they're not intended to be in this bill at this time since 3093 is left.
Oh, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So the bill goes unamended?
That's right.
All right. Do you remember committing back on 429? Senator Walker, I'm sure you have copious notes.
Well, actually, I don't. I was missing an action that day. I don't know why.
I missed an opportunity to move a bill. Now that happened. All right. We're in work session. Anybody have questions or they want to talk about this?
Well, my city councilor from Junction City says it's a good bill and support. So.
Well, they've worked on it substantially during the interim.
Yeah.
It's a consensus bill, Mr. Chairman.
It's kind of a holy grail bill. Nobody wants anybody to touch it. Kind of.
That's right.
Kind of like the law commission bill.
That's right.
Which we'll hear about later.
Great relating clause.
Yeah. Senator Burdick?
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 2425 to the floor of the pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2425 to the floor of the Senate with the pass recommendation. Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion? There are none. Passes. Senator Ringo, would you carry that for me?
Be glad to.
Thank you, sir. That bill is now gone. We have a technical reconsideration of 29.5.
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee. This bill comes back to you. We heard it the other day. It relates to child support, and it's back because you have a conflict amendment from the A4 amendments, and it's to make the bill compatible, or the other bills compatible with this, would be House Bill 2340 and House Bill 2526. Okay.
Senator Bree.
Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2095A was sent to the floor with the due pass as amended with subsequent referral to Ways and Means recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves that we reconsider the vote by which this committee passed out House Bill 2095 before of the Senate with a subsequent rescinding of or did
referral.
Referral to Ways and Means. Whatever she said.
I believe that was a run-on sentence.
Any objection to the motion? We know what we're doing. In front of us. We need to adopt the A4. Amendment, is that correct, Bill? Help me here. Yeah,
I think we needed to motion to reconsider first, and then we do the A4. But if you said we did the A4, I rest assured that we.
No, we need to do the A4. All right, is that right?
It's my turn.
Your turn, Madam Vice Chair.
You went so fast, I got lost. Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the A4 amendments to House Bill 2095A.
Senator Burdick moves we adopt the A4 amendments to House Bill. The heck bill is this again? 2095. Conflict amendments.
Discussion. These are the A3s adopted June 3rd, plus conflict amendments with House Bill 2340C and House Bill 2526B.
Do you have a script?
She does have a script. I'm
insulted. I'm gravely insulted.
I'm the only guy that doesn't have a script here, as you can tell. All right. Any objection to the adoption of the A4? Any discussion on the motion to adopt the A4 amendment? No discussion? Any objections? There's no objection. Motion passed. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2095 to the floor with a due pass as amended with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Burdick now moves House Bill 2095 as amended by this committee before the Senate will do pass. No, we move it to the committee of Ways and Means. What am I doing here?
Yeah.
It's going to Ways and Means.
Jesus,
does this have a subsequent referral?
Yeah, and
it does have.
We don't send it to the floor, and
right.
Then
no. All right, Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2095 as amended by this committee to the Committee on Ways and Means.
There we go.
See, everybody's confusing me today. And I actually got 8 hours sleep.
Well, we didn't, and we went on a 4-mile walk.
I think we're supposed to go back to the floor.
Well, that's what the script says.
Where's
all right. Why is she so mad? No, I'm sorry. Right. So the motion
Byron now, we'll figure it out.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2095, as amended by this committee, to the floor with a due pass as amended with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. That's what the Secretary of the Senate has printed here.
That's right.
That's the motion. Discussion.
I
any
think it's
objections
a
to the motion? Secretary of the Senate knows what she's doing. The bottom line is it's going to go to Ways and Means.
Okay.
Any objections? The motion passes. Thank you. The conflict amendment is in. It's gone. Goodbye. Who's my next victim? Let's see.
Because we're on a roll now.
Bill, do you have any more? Work session 3389. District Attorney Dugan has come all the way from there.
Work session 3389. I think we had this before.
Right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill provides additional means of establishing identity control substance and prosecutions involving control substances. District Attorney Dugan is here, as is Susan Russell. They have agreed on amendments to dash A2 amendments, but I want a step too far. And then on line 10, we need to delete line 10 of the A2 amendments.
So this is a work session. If the committee would look at the A2 amendment, we're going to need a motion to suspend the rules for the purpose of considering a conceptual amendment, which will be the deletion of line 10 on the A2 amendment in front of you.
Chairman, every time we get conceptual amendment, we get in trouble.
No, we don't.
That's why there's no script.
Not when I do it, we don't. Senator Burdick moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of considering a conceptual amendment. Is there any discussion on Senator Burdick's fine motion? Any objection to the motion? There is none. Thank you very much. Now, Senator Burdick, the conceptual amendment is actually in front of us. And, if you look at the A2 amendment, it's very simple. Everybody look at the A2 amendment. On line 10, you're going to delete line 10 of the A2 amendment.
Which deletes lines 20 through 22.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So Senator Burdick moves that we delete lines 10 on the A2 amendment that's before the committee.
Now, that's an easy one.
Any objection to that motion? There's none. Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Burdick, for your cooperation.
Chairman is a ventriloquist.
All right. All right, there we go. Now, let's have a discussion on the A2 amendment, now absent line 10, which was the emergency part of that. This council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what it basically says, when a controlled substance is issued in a criminal proceedings before the grand jury, at a preliminary hearing, the proceedings of district attorney's information for the purposes of early disposition, it is prima facie evidence of the identity of the controlled substance. So if they use the field test for those limited purposes, it would be prima facie evidence.
All right.
No, nothing beyond that. So it would not be something that could happen to my correct, Mr. Dugan, directly in trial.
Susan, do you want to come up? I assume you guys have talked about this, correct? All right. Because I think the last time we had this, we sent you out in the hallway and said, do a huddle and come back.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for having the hearing today, and thank you also for setting us to a back room to discuss this. But we have agreed on that. There's one other agreement that we had that wasn't attached to the amendments, and we both agreed that an emergency clause would be appropriate, in as much as this is an effort to save finances and resources. We thought that if we could get an emergency clause on it, we could start saving money earlier.
That's Mr. Chair. That's not the difficult to add. I mean, if you are right.
But we have suspended the rules for considering this conceptual amendment, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is a House bill. I'm gonna bring this back Monday.
Okay.
Let's put this on Monday's agenda because it gets a little bit confusing for everybody to follow through about that. So we're gonna add an emergency clause. Is that all right? Everybody agree to that? I'm looking for shaking hands. That's okay, Council.
Senator, I assume that District Attorney Dugan does not need to come back for the purposes of...
Well, of course he does. No, actually, every time he comes up here, there's a new amendment, so no, you don't have to come back.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for considering this bill, and I will not come back Monday, although I do enjoy looking at the wildlife on my way over. We saw the elk again this morning.
All right, great. No, notwithstanding the work we did deleting line 10, we'll bring back everything.
Yeah, we'll have one amendment.
Actually, at this juncture, get me back procedurally. I'm going to ask that. Well, we haven't adopted the A2. We amended the A2. So, okay, we're fine. Great. All right. Close the work session.
And Susan Russell on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Open the public hearing.
Association. Just to put on the record that we worked on these Dash A2 amendments, and we no longer oppose the bill with these amendments.
Hey, that's sweet.
That's great. Oh, hey, guess what? Council set this for tomorrow, so it's on tomorrow's agenda. So if we get the amendments, we'll do it tomorrow. Okay? Okay? Okay. Is that okay? Everybody okay? All right. Thank you very much. Close the work session on 3389. Gosh, we're having fun today. So let me see. I got a bunch of DAs out here. Actually, you know what I do? I got to do the Law Commission. They got a couple of public hearings on a couple of bills that they screwed up last session or something.
Oh, jeez.
Bring them up here on 2276, public hearing. Come on up here, Wendy. Do your mea culpa.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. These are two civil rights bills that are coming back from the last session. In 2001, the Oregon Law Commission recommended a large bill that reorganized all of Chapter 659 to make civil rights claims easier to file and find out where they are in the statute. And we did make a couple of mistakes with that large bill.
Could you say that again?
We did make a couple of mistakes, actually two omissions. The first bill that's before you is House Bill 2275, and all that bill does is add age clearly back into a protected class for public accommodations claims. Specifically, Section 1 puts that back in, age, and then has the two exceptions, one for senior citizens and one for minors. And then Section 2 of the bill revives all those claims that were lost from January 1st, 2002, when the Commission's recommended bill became effect, House Bill 2352. So that is the first bill.
Which one's the first bill? Say it again.
House Bill 2275.
2275. No one else signed up on 2275. Work session 2275. Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2275 to be sent forward to pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2275 before the Senate to pass recommendation. Any discussion? Wendy, any other changes?
There are no amendments. It's a consensus bill, and we're aware of no opposition.
All right. Hopefully we don't see it back on this next session. No or omissions, exactly. All right. Any objection to the motion? Here's done. The motion passes. And who hasn't gotten a vote here?
Senator
Carr, you want to carry that?
I'll do it
for you. Thank you very much. 2276, why don't you tell us about that in public?
Chairman, members of the committee, again, Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. House Bill 2276 also involves an omission. Two statutes were left out of a long string. These statutes involve injured worker claims. 659A043 is that provision that allows a claim for reinstatement of injured workers to their former position, and ORS 659A.046 is the provision that allows a claim for reemployment of an injured worker who is unable to return to their former position because they need a suit, accommodation of some sort. The damages for those two claims was left out of the large reorganization bill from last session. This bill would reinstate that. Specifically in Section 1, those two statutes are added back in, and then in Section 2, we revive all those claims lost after January 1st, 2002.
All right, great. Discussion, any questions? Want to grill Wendy? Nope. Work session.
Chairman?
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2276 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2276 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. No last-minute amendments?
No, Chairman, thank you. We did have a member of Boley here today. These were our mistakes, and so we're taking control of getting those through to fix it back up.
All right.
Thank you.
And thank you for being, well, at least going along with my fun, or what I perceive to be fun, which may not be. Anyway. Any objection to the motion? None. Motion passed. Senator Starr, would you carry that one also, Senator?
I'll do it.
Both. All right. What do I have left, Council?
2318, did you announce that?
2318, I did announce earlier. It was not going to be dealt with.
2865.
2865. Public hearing. Who do we have here? Got a whole host of folks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this comes to you from the Judiciary Committee. It allows the district attorney to treat certain non-person felonies as Class A misdemeanors, allows information. An official police report is presented to the grand jury by police officer involved in investigation. Provides a defendant who refuses to provide true name may be released except upon payment of full security. You have two amendments in front of you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The Dash 5 amendments come into you as a result of some discussions on the House side with Representative Patridge and others on fines, fees, and assessments. And what the Dash 5 amendments do, looking down the lines of 11 and 13, what it would do is it would increase the maximum fine for a felony reduced to a Class A misdemeanor. It would keep the maximum fine at the Class C felony rate. And the reason for having it here is because this is the bill that allows for reduction, district attorney, after indictment to reduce felonies, a Class A misdemeanor.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Okay. And the current status of the law is that has to occur. It's currently allowed, but only by the court, I believe, after.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. You're right, by the court. So what you would have would be an appointment of counsel and everything.
Right.
This would allow for the reduction before appointment of counsel.
Right.
And then the A6 amendments are here from Susan Russell. This is an issue that was discussed in the House, and this is a policy issue which would relate to what may be brought before the grand jury as far as hearsay evidence.
All right. We have Chuck French and John Bradley, now retired, I understand. Either that or you're in private practice. I'm not sure which.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, I'm John Bradley, a private citizen now. I was involved in putting this bill together. It really came about when the legislature, the Committee on the Judiciary, asked that we look at ways in which we could cut costs. And what we did is we put together three things in which we thought we could save costs. for both the courts and police agencies. House Bill 2865 is divided into three parts. I'll talk about two of them. The first part says that the district attorney may elect to treat certain, well, non-person C felonies as misdemeanors, and also a violation of ORS 475.992A, which is possession of controlled substances, Schedule 1, also treating those as misdemeanors. This requires that the district attorney establish standards so that equally situated defendants will be treated similarly. When this came up before the House, Doug Harfelrode, the district attorney from Lane County, testified in his favor, said that this is a very important thing for Lane County. It's also a very important thing for Multnomah County, and also indicated that the ODA supported the bill. I think you have a letter from District Attorney Michael Schrunk, my former employer. In it, he points out there's several reasons just besides the cost savings effect of this. As a practical matter, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office on a number of C felonies in the past have treated them as misdemeanors. The only vehicle that we have to treat a C felony currently as a misdemeanor is to treat it as an attempt. In other words, if we have a felony DWS and we want to proceed on those as misdemeanors, we have to charge them as attempted DWSs. What this bill will do is it'll allow us to treat the charge as what it actually is rather than an attempt. The other thing is, Mr. Schrunk notes in his letter, we've had a number of judges who I don't think they've made the correct decision, but nonetheless have decided that if a completed act has been committed, an attempt is not a lesser included, and they actually have thrown us out of court on a number of cases because they've said this isn't an attempted act, this is a completed act. This is a thing that Mr. Harkerode and I both said that we thought that we would never be coming before the legislature, suggesting to the legislature to make C felonies misdemeanors, but the times have changed, obviously. The resources have changed, and I think this is something that district attorneys have done and will continue to do, especially with the budget problems. And again, I think this is it saves money in the sense that the district attorney can charge these initially as misdemeanors, and the indigent defense costs will be greatly reduced. I believe both the OCDLA and the Judicial Department support this particular part of the bill. The second part of the bill deals with grand juries. I'll leave that to Chuck French. The third part of the bill, and I would suggest is a very important part of the bill, it will protect innocent people. Every day, or just about, I won't say every day, but often in Multnomah County, innocent people are convicted, people who have never been to court. And what happens is this. I come into court, and the judge says, "What's your name?" And I say, "My name is Chuck French." And this is actually Chuck French. The law allows that to happen. And the law allows us to proceed unless it's caught. I can proceed as Chuck French. And what happens is I go through the system. If I don't get a bench warrant, let's say I'm convicted, and I'm convicted, I'm given a $200 fine, and then I go away. So the first thing that happens is Chuck French, when he's ready to get his income tax returns, all of a sudden finds out that his income tax returns were garnished because of the fact that he had this judgment, and he doesn't know anything about it. And I would say 2 to 3 times a week in Multnomah County, we have, and it perhaps even is more often than that, we have people who come to our front counter who say, "I've been convicted of a crime, and I've never been in court." And it used to be, when we all had adequate resources, what we would do is we'd send the person back to the police bureau to make sure we had the right person, or we had the wrong person. Oftentimes, we had the wrong person, and then we'd have to come back, we'd have to do amended orders, and go through a number of steps. That still happens, but we don't have the resources, and the Portland Police Bureau, they don't have the resources. So when I say every day or every week innocent people are convicted, it's true. I mean, you get convicted, you don't even know about it until, sometime you apply for a job, all of a sudden something is garnished and you don't understand why.
What the third section says, it basically says the court has to make some effort to make a determination on what the true name of the defendant is. Now, this is one of a number of steps that's going to take some time to achieve before we can get to that point where we're going to be relatively sure that we actually have the right person. Again, there are other steps that today is just not the day to discuss them. I mean, they have some fiscal things. It's something we've discussed with the Portland Police Bureau, we've discussed with our sheriff's office, and we're moving in that direction. But this is a critical piece of trying to establish the true identity of when someone comes into court. Again, the OCDLA is neutral on this. They don't support it. They don't oppose it. With that, I'll turn it over to Chuck French to explain the second section. And also, as far as the amendments go, as far as the amendment increasing the fines for the Class A misdemeanors to $100,000, we don't have any objection to that. As far as the other amendment that the OCDLA are going to offer, Mr. French will address that.
Thank you, Chairman. As members of the committee, my name is Chuck French. I'm a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. One of the things that I'm responsible for in that office is the administration of the grand jury, at least to the extent that we work in the grand jury in Multnomah County. Multnomah County currently has three grand juries in full-time operation at the same time. When budget problems began rising 2 or 3 years ago, we began examining some of the processes that we were involved in to see if we could save money somewhere. It's immediately apparent, and I'm sure Chairman is sure aware of this, that the Portland Police Bureau spends a lot of money on overtime costs for Portland police officers testifying in grand juries. I believe the costs run almost to $1 million a year for that agency. Many of the officers who testify in grand juries are testifying about relatively minor things like that they had in their possession drugs and passed them from one person to another into the evidence locker. We began to examine that process and looked at the counterpart grand jury in the federal system and decided that we could do better, at least in terms of savings, by a few brief amendments. And I should say there is no opposition to the general concept here. I understand from the Defense Lawyers Association there is a disagreement about how far this bill should go. What the bill does, members of the committee, is to allow evidence that would not be admitted under certain trial hearsay code provisions, would allow that testimony if a police officer who was involved in the actual investigation has police reports written by other sworn police officers involved in the same investigation, it would allow him to testify about what was contained in those police reports. That hearsay exception that we have attempted to write into this bill is far more restrictive than its federal counterpart, which essentially allows any hearsay testimony in a federal grand jury. By doing so, we felt that we would not only save grand jury time, we would save money for the Portland Police Bureau and the Oregon State Police by not having officers come up and testify, but we'd also put more police officers out on the street. What essentially happens now is that an officer will be off, especially if he's on duty, will be off duty for 3 to 4 hours waiting to testify, or 2 to 3 hours waiting to testify about a very minor issue before the grand jury. This bill would allow a fellow officer who's involved in the same investigation to testify about his piece of that investigation. For the Oregon State Police, for instance, who are strained to the limits now, a patrol officer might have to come from 100 miles away and be gone for an entire day just to testify that he, for instance, took a statement from a witness or took a statement from a defendant or handled a piece of evidence. So essentially this bill was designed to save money, and it was designed to follow the federal procedure, except we didn't go near as far as the federal process allows federal prosecutors.
All right. Senator Burdick.
What's the penalty for lying in front of a grand jury?
That would be, it depends upon what you're lying about. There are two crimes in the state of Oregon. One is perjury. That's a Class C felony with a potential 5-year prison sentence, and obviously the same sentencing guidelines, gridlock, would apply depending on your criminal background as to what the judge would actually sentence you to. The other crime, and you would be guilty of perjury if you lied in a material element of the crime. That is something which is substantially important to what you're testifying about. If you were lying simply about, if you went before a grand jury and you were lying about something that was not material element, like you wanted to inflate your background and say that you had a number of degrees that you did not have, or that you you had a resume you didn't have, that's not a material thing that you're lying about, so the crime there would be false swearing, and that's a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. if you had one officer testifying on another officer's report and there was a lie in the report, who gets the perjury charge against him?
Well, now that my analysis of that would be if an so you're saying an officer lied in a police report.
Lied in a report.
If the other officer, if for instance I wrote something that was intentionally false on my police report, and then I handed it to Mr. Bradley, who was another police officer and went in and testified about that. If Mr. Bradley knew that that was a lie, then he would be guilty of perjury because it was a sworn statement that he knew to be false. If for instance, I just handed it to him unwittingly and he unwittingly testified about something that was false, my guess is that it would be there would be no perjury or false swearing charge, although there would be another crime, which would be official misconduct on the part of the police officer, which would also be that the officer who'd written the false report and handed that in would also be guilty of official misconduct, which is
an A
misdemeanor at the same level as false swearing.
So, Mr. Chairman, what if the report was ambiguously written and the way it was presented was information that was a lie to the detriment of the defendant, and that was later uncovered? So the officer maybe wrote an ambiguous report, the other officer interpreted it in a way that was a material lie to the detriment of the defendant, then who gets charged with perjury?
Well, again, Chair Minnison, Senator Burdick, I believe that in a situation like that, if what the officer had done was intentionally write a police report that was you're saying ambiguous, but was designed so that it would fly through the grand jury and get someone, for instance, indicted who was not guilty, that would be an official misconduct on the part of the officer who wrote that report, and that again is a Class A misdemeanor.
But then what if it was unintentionally ambiguous and was interpreted to the detriment of the defendant, and of course the officer who wrote it in the first place was not present to be questioned, so the ambiguity could not be resolved. It was misinterpreted by the other officer who was not able to respond to questions about the ambiguity. You know, and yet here you have a defendant who has been put in harm's way by an ambiguity, and they're in normal, and if everybody was responsible for their own work, you would have somebody to come after. But in this case, who would you go after?
Well, there wouldn't actually, Chair Minnison, Senator Burdick, I don't believe there, under that scenario, that there would be anyone who could be prosecuted under the current law or a prospective law. And the reason for that is that if someone had put something ambiguously into a police report with no intent to mislead anyone, just as if that person had testified in the grand jury, there's no criminal mental state on the part of that witness, and that witness couldn't be prosecuted in the past or under the scenario here for anything. The question you're raising, I think, is the question of that individual would not be able to be fully examined by the members of the grand jury, not whether or not that person could be prosecuted, because the person who wrote a sloppy police report or testified sloppily in front of a grand jury couldn't be prosecuted for anything unless they did so intentionally with a design to mislead someone. So it's not an issue of prosecuting someone. It's an issue of could the grand jury fully examine the evidence before it? And our position on that simply is that this is a standard that the federal government is far more expansive of than even what we're proposing here.
Let me ask you a couple of questions, having been in grand jury and both of you, I think, presenting cases that I brought to you. If you had ambiguous police reports or reports that were not clear, my sense would be that you would either ask me specific questions, or if I was unclear about that, you would subpoena that officer who wrote the report to make clarification, because generally your intent is not to present ambiguous information before a grand jury, because that doesn't support your purpose, which is to obtain an indictment and have that all of the information presented. So, and we'll try to put this in context. It seems to me that there are not many prosecutors out there that would look at a report that was confusing and ambiguous and then ask another officer to testify to what that says, or try to interpret it, so to speak. You're not going to ask me to interpret Officer X's statement here if, in fact, it's ambiguous, because I'm going to get in front of the grand jury and say, I haven't got a clue what this person's saying.
Chairman, I agree with that, and should add that there are a number of exceptions to the evidence code hearsay laws that exist right now in the state statutes that allow for the submission of affidavits before the grand jury. So affidavits can be submitted before a grand jury under certain circumstances, and that carries with it the same issues that we're dealing with here, whether or not those might be ambiguous or not ambiguous. So it's the same. We have essentially the same situation with affidavits as we're proposing in this bill, and we have not experienced any problems with that I'm aware of in the history of the statute, which has allowed affidavits and videotaped television testimony into the grand jury proceedings.
Let me ask another question. Has your office ever prosecuted a police officer for false statements or false police reports or false affidavits? Or
we have once that I'm aware of.
Yes,
I was going to say, and I was actually chatting with Senator Walker here. I mean, the district attorney's office in our county takes very seriously the reports that are submitted and the testimony given before any grand jury or any court. And they've been pretty unabashed about prosecuting police officers or other individuals, particularly police officers.
And, Chairman, that had to do with where an officer stated that he had more credentials than he actually had.
Right.
He said he'd done some things that he hadn't done.
Right.
That was a long time ago, too.
Right. It has been, and I used to work with that officer. Okay. I want to get Susan Russell up here. We're not going to be able to move on this bill yet today. I think we've got some other issues we need to bring forward and discuss, but let's try to get things laid out. And I want to make sure, in my mind, whose amendments are these again, the E5 and E6, are those?
Susan Russell, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. A6, I believe, is the OCDL amendment, which would limit the grand jury testimony of another officer to chain of custody. And just briefly to go through, I think both Mr. Bradley and Mr. French have accurately represented, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, our position, which is with respect to the first provision that the district attorneys have the power to treat certain non-person felonies as misdemeanors. We think that is an excellent provision as a cost-saving measure. With respect to the third amendment, attempting to identify people under their true names as they're being arraigned in court, we no longer oppose that part of the bill. We did on the House side, and Mr. Bradley has carefully amended that provision in order to address our concerns, which would that originally were that the defendant would be put in sort of this quandary if the statements could be used against him or her in any criminal proceedings, either pending or future. And that has been amended to limit the use of a defendant's statements to a perjury proceeding. We believe that's a fair provision. And so we no longer oppose that aspect. But we do oppose and have serious concern with allowing a peace officer involved in investigation to testify in a grand jury proceeding to what another officer has written in the reports.
without it being limited in scope. And our proposed -A6 amendments would limit that to a chain of custody. We understand the district attorney's concerns and the financial constraints, and do not see why officers need to be coming to grand juries simply to saying that they took evidence A and handed it to another officer. And I understand that a lot of times in these cases there may be numerous officers that are involved in the chain of custody, that that doesn't serve anybody's purpose. They have no meaningful information to relay. And I see in Mr. French is that he's talking about non-critical testimony, but in addition to, or he limits it to saying chain of custody issues and other kinds of non-critical testimony. Unfortunately, the bill as drafted isn't limited to what we would say is non-critical testimony and would allow hearsay of critical testimony. I think Senator Burdick has raised some really interesting points already, and many of our concerns. But the other concern, I think, you know, officers, you know, purposely lying, I think, is a rarity, but there is a concern about ambiguity, and particularly when, you know, the district attorney may think it's very clear and present information. Having myself been subpoenaed by the district attorney and having testified once at a grand jury, I can represent, and I'm sure that Mr. Bradley and Mr. French wouldn't disagree, that grand jurors participate often very actively in questioning, and I'm sure that Senator Chairmanis can also agree from his own. And that's something different that we don't see at trial. And having not been, if you have not been a grand juror witness, it surprised me to what extent that the grand jurors took over the questioning and went on maybe three or four times longer than the district attorney. When the witness who's actually made the report or made the observations, maybe interviewed the defendant, has questioned a victim and has observations about the victim's demeanor, may have made a crime scene sort of, you know, a appraisal, isn't there, then I think that what you're going to get is that the grand jurors are going to be chilled in terms of their willingness to ask questions and participate. And I think that the grand jury process works really well because you have these citizens that are sort of untrained citizens that can actually participate and question.
Can I ask you a question on that point? Again, going back to my experience, because oftentimes grand juries, and I've had this experience where they've refused to actually render a judgment until the district attorney's brought additional testimony.
And Mr. Chair, that's correct. I've had a case where I wasn't a witness, but in which it was a very weak case for the state. I think it was actually a case by representation of the district attorney where they didn't really want to proceed and were hoping in some ways or wanted the grand jury to take that responsibility. And it was a no true bill, which is a very rare determination by grand jury, which is basically an acquittal saying that no future proceedings could be brought, and that they've decided, the grand jury, based on the evidence, that there is no evidence, that there's no evidence to proceed, and in fact that there's a bar to future prosecution. So in one case I've had that happen out of, I don't know, 1,000 plus cases that I've handled over the last 10 years where the jurors have sent out that I'm aware of. There may have been other cases where it didn't become an issue. And of course, they have that capability, but I guess our concern is that when witnesses aren't there, when officers are testifying, it can be communicated to the grand jury that this is not significant information. If it was, the witness would be there. And so while there are a legally trained, a very savvy grand juror may be able to address all these problems, we don't always have that kind of situation. And so by not having the witness there, the grand jurors can be given the impression that this is not an important information, it's not a matter for inquiry, that the defendant's statements or questions or ambiguity should not be followed up with, and they may not either be encouraged or understand their ability to do that kind of inquiry.
Senator Burdick.
If the -A6 amendments were passed, would you support the whole bill or not oppose the whole bill?
Ms. Chair, Senator Berger, yes, we would. We would no longer oppose the second aspect, the grand jury proceeding aspect.
Right.
And then the A5 amendments, I have no clue where. Oh, that's the increase of the fine. And you're fine with those as well?
And Ms. Chair, Senator Berger, we have no problem with that, or no objection to that.
All right. And
Mr. Chair, members, just one very, very brief final point. When we're talking about the federal grand jury proceedings, I agree that the representations been made are correct, but it's also important to bear in mind that other provisions apply at federal grand juries, such as that all federal grand jury proceedings are recorded as a requirement of federal statute. So,
thank you.
they have to be recorded. So that's not something that applies here in Oregon, and we've often and have a bill again this year that suggests that that should happen, which has not had a hearing and is unlikely probably to proceed. But it's just important to bear in mind that when we're talking about different sort of jurisdictions, that there are other things that that apply that don't apply.
Are you suggesting that if you did have grand jury recordation, you would support this provision?
There would still be concerns, but I certainly think we would have less concerns.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank Ms. Russell for putting in a plug for the reason why court reporters exist and that we do perform a good function.
All right. Senator Ringo? Chuck, do you want to come up and say anything? Or you?
Well, if I'm being afforded that opportunity, Chairman.
You bet. Absolutely.
Chairman, as members of the committee, my only reflection on what Ms. Russell has said, and I've worked with her for many years, and she's made a very effective presentation here, but in breaking this down as to what we are seeking here, and that is seeking to use certain evidence in a grand jury proceeding to obtain an indictment. Or not obtain an indictment, I think you have to compare it with some of the other things that are allowed in our law in Oregon. We may obtain, or at least we can seek and obtain generally search warrants to search someone's house. We can seek and obtain an arrest warrant to arrest an individual based on, as I'm sure you're aware, Chairman, having done many of them, I think sometimes in conjunction with me, on investigations, we can get a judge to sign a warrant based upon the hearsay testimony of a police officer in an affidavit. We can get a judge to sign a warrant to arrest someone based upon the same evidence, search or arrest. And so essentially I don't see any real distinction between using that that evidence, hearsay evidence, in an affidavit to obtain a search or arrest warrant, or using similar hearsay, but much more restricted hearsay evidence before a grand jury to obtain an indictment. It's something that we're very comfortable with in the law in Oregon, allowing hearsay testimony for legal purposes to proceed in a prosecution. And it really is, as I say, we believe we've tailored it quite restrictively and far more restrictively than, for instance, an officer who seeks a search or an arrest warrant. So that would be my response to that.
All right. Thank you very much. I would ask that you and Ms. Russell continue to chat on this particular issue, and perhaps we can find some common ground and move forward. We've got some time left. Session's indeterminate in terms of its end. So, I think officially today is the end of the session.
Tomorrow is 6.
Is it tomorrow is 6? Okay.
D-Day.
Tomorrow's D-Day. Tonight's the signy die party. Okay. Any other business before the committee? If not, there is a scheduled Friday morning meeting at 8 a.m. We should be getting an agenda for it. Senator Burdick will be absent. Mr. Taylor.
John, I think we double scheduled everything that was on today for tomorrow, but I take it you'd probably want this bill to be scheduled sometime next week.
I think so. I think we probably should set this over, and there are some other related issues that are going to be brought before the committee that will relate to some of these issues. So,
okay, so I'll wait for the chair to help you there.
All right. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.